Ever wonder why 95% of leads do not convert? Why cold call rates are down and prospects don't open our emails? Why our responses of robocalls and implanting pixels to track user interaction, mostly without permission, is backfiring spectacularly? Well, that's what we intend to find out here in the Buyerside Chat podcast. There are scores of podcasts about selling, but most miss the shift that has come upon the buying-selling process. The initiative has since moved from the supply to the demand side. The Buyerside Chat, your podcast of record for B2B buying, talks to actual buyers, persons, not personas, in the quest to understand the real buyer's journey, their trials and tribulations, challenges and outcomes they're striving for. Welcome to the Buyerside Chat. Thank you for your time and for joining us on this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give a shout out to each of you in our next episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Today, we have with us Awal Sethi, Head of Procurement at Embassy Services.
The paradox of being a successful negotiator is that you can't be caught negotiating. Now, the really good negotiators, actually, if you look at it, always go under the radar. Deal makers who grab headlines tend to be very boisterous, larger than life types, who welcome conflict. They end up in arguments and raised voices and so on. But in the long term, it never really brings in results. So while clashing goals are at the heart of negotiations, but we must always remember that it's not a power struggle. And if you actually look at, and I quite often Sun Tzu, the Chinese philosopher and the famous general, who thousands of years ago had said that success in warfare is gained by carefully accommodating ourselves to the enemy's purpose. Even after so many years, even after years of analysis and research by psychologists and business thinkers, they've eventually come to the same conclusion. Be understanding your adversary, their needs, and what value you might bring to them. The question that a negotiator is always trying to ask and answer is, what do I bring to the table that's of value to the other side? Which actually, if you look at it in other words, it's actually saying, what can they not do without me? Or why are they sitting with me here in the first place?
Awal started his career in the Indian Army and moved to the corporate world, where he has worked in different industries and organizations like iEnergizer, Bechel, JLL, and Proteica. Awal brings in over 26 years of rich experience in multidisciplinary areas of procurement transformation, strategic planning and negotiations, critical supplier development, and relationship management with a clear leadership focus on driving enterprise value. Awal has various accomplishments and awards to his credit, both while in military service as well as in the corporate world. He was named among the top 50 global thought leaders and influencers in procurement and is a member of the advisory panel of Entrepreneurship Development Center of the Delhi Technological University. He is an alumni of Delhi University, Symbiosis Institute of Management Studies, Indian School of Business, and the National University of Singapore. Now, on to this great episode with Awal Sethi. Awal, welcome to the Buyerside Chat. I'm delighted to have you as a guest on the show. We had a wonderful time in the webinar we did together, and I was quite, taken by all the interesting and open nature with which you shared. And I'm really, really glad that you could make time and join me today. To get started, let's dive right in. How does a buyer decide to buy?
So thank you so much, Subhanjan, for having invited me to this chat. And I'm really looking forward to sharing my thoughts and my views on this. So it's a very interesting question on what pushes the buyer to buy. Now, I would like to firstly go back into a little history to talk about what initiates and brings the buyer to a table with a seller. Now, for any requirement within an organization, there is obviously, firstly, a need that has to come up. That need mostly is determined by somebody on the operation side or somebody who's managing the day-to-day affairs within an organization. And it could differ from the organizational structure and the business that that organization is in. But once that need comes up, there is a business case that would be required to be built up. So either an individual or a team comes together and they then determine what is the business need actually. And then after they've homed on to the business need, they will start developing justifications around it. And the justifications will have probably two or three critical pillars around it. The first one would obviously be a cost analysis. Is it really worthwhile? Does it really make sense? How will it commercially benefit the organization or the function or the department on which or from where the need has arisen?
Right.
Once they've determined that, the second pillar goes on to a benefit analysis. Now, yes, cost, I can get something or maybe there's a solution available which can give me a cost benefit, but on a long-term basis, will it really benefit the organization? Does a product or a service really time well into the organization's growth path or the organization's future? So that's the second pillar that probably the assessment is done on. And the third aspect or the third very important pillar is the value delivery. That if I get that product or a service, is it going to create value? Is it going to create value in the short term? Because I have a short term objective, I have an emergent requirement, I think this is a need, I need it fixed and so on. Or I'm looking at a midterm value creation or something which will last me over the probably a life cycle of an organization for the next 10, 20 years, and it'll be really wonderful to integrate a product or a service within the organizational structure. Once all that is laid out and the individual or the team is very clear, the next step that goes forward is actually creating a whole business case around that piece and then taking it up for approvals within your organizational hierarchy. Now, that individual could have his supervisor. There could be other managerial hierarchies to deal with. So there could be a business head, there could be a CFO, there could be a CEO. There will be a presentation that will happen. You will need to get a buy-in from all these stakeholders to really say, yes, this is a requirement, there is a benefit commercially, there is a value to it, there is a benefit, and so on. Obviously, I would also caveat this to say, this process may not happen for every product or service,
right,
but
right.
for wherever there is a large stake that is involved right. in this process. Now, once all that is done and the individual gets a thumbs up from the organization, it could be the CFO or the CEO, it flows into the next step. And the next step is now, how do I find a solution to this? Where do I go? So, I have identified a need. I know what I want, but how do I get it? And that's the time that individual now says, okay, I need a procurement function. I need somebody to go out to the market. But even before I do that, for that procurement function, I need to lay down certain parameters. And one of or a few of those parameters will be defining the scope. What exactly do I want? Because procurement is a little away from day-to-day requirements or day-to-day operations.
Yeah.
Unless I really handhold and tell him or tell that person or that buyer in the procurement function what exactly I need, he will not be able to do justice. And therefore, the parameters has to be crystal. And so I need to define a scope in detail. I actually have to go a step ahead and define the service levels that I want or I expect from that product or a service, and also then go about and lay down the key performance indicators for that product and the service.
Right.
Now, with that, when I take it to the procurement function, now the procurement is very clear on what the expectations are. What is it that the user requires? How will it be measured? What are the parameters? And so on. Now, the initiation for a procurement to start their job comes from a purchase requisition. And the purchase requisition is essentially a document which captures all of what I've said. So putting everything in print for the procurement to really read through it and understand. And once they've understood is when they are ready now to get to the market. Now, that product or a service could either be something that is readily available in the market and there are many options to it. So life is easier for a procurement professional because all he needs to do is identify quickly 6, 7, 8 suppliers for that product service, reach out to them, ask them for a quotation, and then carry on with the rest of the process. But when there is not too many people out there with that product or a service, it actually becomes imperative for a procurement professional first to understand, then to reach out into the market to do some kind of an analysis, and then to identify who is actually offering that solution in the market, and then start his entire buying process. Now, to start the buying process also for a procurement guy, it starts with a request for either a quotation or a proposal. Now, there is again a differentiation between these two. And a lot of people actually can't differentiate between what is a request for a proposal and a request for a quotation.
Right.
And I'll probably not get into the details of differentiation between these two.
Yeah.
But essentially, they will reach out and request for either one of these from the suppliers. And once they receive inputs from the market, they will then sit back and start to analyze.
Yeah, in fact, there is one step, even in some cases I've seen, they also have something called request for information, RFI, which is which is even before the RFP or the RFQ, right?
So, yes, absolutely.
So it can, depending upon the complexity or what they're dealing with, the stages might vary. Before you move on, Awal, I have one question that is in my mind and I want to ask you now. See, one of the things that we have understood is that traditionally the procurement role, the role of the buyer who actually is not the buyer, not the beneficiary, but just is fulfilling a buying function, which essentially boiled down to a negotiation function. In some of my discussions, what is coming up is that in this new digital procurement era where we are, this role may actually go extinct because the actual user or the beneficiary or who is raising the requirement will be able to do this whole function of finding the possible suppliers and talking to them. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So that's actually a very interesting thought, and I've heard a number of variations to this thought. So there are proponents and theories that look, as we move forward, the procurement as a function that we know today may cease to exist. I say definitely, the way that you look at procurement today will cease to exist. But procurement itself will be strengthened in the digital era. It will have much more tools available to them to do a much better job. The people that manage procurement today will be far more informed, will be far more agile, will be doing a job which is far advanced than what they're doing today. If I were to take a minute and actually talk about a little more around that piece. So if you look at the people in procurement today, now the majority or the bulk of the people in procurement have actually stumbled and just by chance happened to land up in procurement. And I'm talking more from an Indian standpoint, because there has, till very recently, there has never been a formal qualification or an education in our schools, colleges, universities, and even MBAs for that matter, B schools and all, which give you a structured formal education in procurement and supply chain. So the people that you have today have come in either from admin departments or support functions or operations who've probably not been able to do a good job at operations because of the skill set and so on. And they said, okay, why don't you try your hand at procurement? And they've all landed up in procurement. And what they've learned is actually on the job. On the job for what work they're doing today. But the nature of the work itself is changing because of the digitization. Now, either these people shape up and adopt to the digital mindset, or they will have to ship out and a new series or a new class of people are going to come in into this function to manage this function. Now, to your point that probably the requester himself will have probably tools to do the buying. Now, I would probably counter that thought to say that every function is a separate entity and its own and carries its own responsibilities and has to have a detailed focus around it to be able to do a good job. Now, if a procurement person leaves procurement and starts doing an operational work, somewhere his own function is going to suffer because he only has that much time and bandwidth allocation to do a job. Similarly, on the operation side or a requester, if he starts to look at procurement and starts to go through the whole life cycle of a buying, he will probably have to trade off some of his time on his operations and his other side.
Yeah.
So you will require a person to actually doing the buying. Now you call him operations guy, you call him procurement person, you call him the requester or whoever, but you would need that one person to look after that requirement.
Right, fair enough. Okay, so we were at the RFP, RFQ generation point at that when I sort of interjected.
Right.
So let's go from there. Where does it land up from there?
So Subhanjan, to your point of the RFI, yes, it is also a very important point. And so depending on the nature of the requirement for the product or the service, it may be a case where there is very limited information that is available in the market, or there are not too many suppliers offering that kind of solution. So it will force the procurement to actually get into the market to do an assessment and analysis. And in that process, they may come through some solutions or some suppliers who are offering something similar to what their requirements are. And the buyer then would actually send out a document, which is the RFI, request for information, to that supplier to try and capture a few critical aspects from the supplier. And some of them would be the organizational setup of the supplier, its capabilities, its presence in the market, and so on. Also, what is the solution that they are offering? How long and is the solution tested in the market? Have they been running, piloted, or a solution running with a few of their clients, and what is the feedback, and so on. But if that solution, the product, is available in the market with a few people around, then they could probably proceed with an RFP and an RFQ and start to approach suppliers and start getting, inviting the proposals or the quotations from these suppliers. Now, the procurement function may land up with multiple such proposals or quotations or RFIs from suppliers. And the next step always is for the team to sit down together and start doing an assessment. And they will do this assessment based on the requisition that has come to them from the user. This is which they will probably shortlist a few of these suppliers, and they will now aim to set up certain meetings with these suppliers. And these meetings are firstly, as a first step, going to be very broad-based meetings, because if the procurement buyer is still not very clear if the supplier is the right supplier, does he actually match up to the requirements, or what percentage does he match up to? And therefore, the next step always is a knowledge sharing or an education session that kickstarts. So the supplier would probably be called in, and he would be asked to explain their product or a service in a little more detail. And there will be an open conversation around what the requirements of that organization are, which is very broadly and loosely configured at that moment, versus what is it that the supplier has to offer. And in that discussion, there could be a lot of interesting points and comments and knowledge that may come up, which a buyer will always make notes about to take it back to the requester. Some of the aspects that probably a buyer will always focus on is, again, going back to how will it benefit? What is the value that will be delivered? Defining that benefit and that value in the short term, the midterm, or the long term. There could be either just one session or there could be multiple sessions. Still, a buyer is clear that yes, or he's identified and shortlisted a few key players to say, yes, I am now quite convinced, I am now quite confident relatively that these are the suppliers who actually match up or meet close to what I'm expecting from a solution standpoint. And that is the time, once the buyer is clear, they try and get into the next level, which is the negotiation piece. Now, I'm very passionate about this whole negotiations as part of the whole entire journey of a buyer.
Right.
And probably, if you permit, I'd like to talk a little bit about the changing dynamics of negotiation.
Absolutely.
In this whole digital era and the digital age. Because like I said earlier, from where we started a couple of years ago and the capability of the teams coming from traditional roles to now looking at the future, and especially now with the pandemic that we've seen with COVID-19 and the businesses moving towards a digital environment and creating digital strategies, it is imperative for the procurement functions also to start adopting digital. And the whole paradigm of the negotiations is also going to change.
Right.
So if I can talk a little about the whole negotiation piece.
Yes, yes, please. Go ahead. I mean, I think a lot of interesting ideas are floating around, starting from Chris Voss and his hostage negotiation to what have you. Please go ahead. I think that's a very, very important piece in the whole transaction process.
So firstly, if I were to talk about negotiations, something that is very dear to me, and I've always told a lot of people, is that the paradox of being a successful negotiator is that you can't be caught negotiating. Now, the really good negotiators, actually, if you look at it, always go under the radar. Deal makers who grab headlines tend to be very boisterous, larger than life types, who welcome conflict. And we've seen that. I've seen that personally in a lot of my organizations that I've been with my teams. And some of them love conflict. they end up in arguments and raised voices and so on. But in the long term, it never really brings in results. So while clashing goals are at the heart of negotiations, but we must always remember that it's not a power struggle in the sense that the most forceful person in the room will always win, which is right. Because a buyer will always say that, look, I will buy at my terms. Yes, somewhere I will compromise in what I want. I may dilute some of the scope or some of the other performance indicators if it gives me a huge commercial advantage. But if it really dilutes it down too extensively, then it is something that doesn't interest me. Now, in this year, say 2020, and as we look and going forward, chances are that negotiators will not even sit in the same room. Technology has enabled a mobile workforce, and with professionals working anytime, anywhere, the art of negotiating, which actually be shifting going forward.
Right.
Now, whether you're bargaining with a vendor via video conferencing or emailing your manager across multiple time zones, the medium will eventually affect some part of your message. But given that so many professional goals depend on your ability to come to favorable terms, understanding the nuances of deal making in the digital age also become very critical.
Right.
Now let's look at probably how do you create value? While technology will change aspects of negotiation, but the basics will remain the same. And if you actually look at, and I quite often than not quote Sun Tzu, the Chinese philosopher and the famous general, who thousands of years ago had said that success in warfare is gained by carefully accommodating ourselves to the enemy's purpose. Now, if you actually deep dive into this statement, and it's a very famous statement by Sun Tzu, even after so many years, even after years of analysis and research by psychologists and business thinkers, they've eventually come to the same conclusion. Understanding your adversary, their needs, and what value you might bring to them. And the real most important source of value in a negotiation is actually your ability to create value for the other side. Now, so regardless of what your outside options are, regardless of your personality style, regardless of how tough somebody sounds when they speak, the question that a negotiator is always trying to ask and answer is, what do I bring to the table that's of value to the other side? Which actually, if you look at it in other words, it's actually saying, what can they not do without me? Or why are they sitting with me here in the first place? Now, these are two questions which, if you look at from a seller's point of view, is something that I have yet to see a seller asking themselves these two pertinent questions, right? And another thing that I actually talk about is that if you were to gain an advantage in a negotiation, you have to take emotions out of the process. But also you must remember that it's not about the power struggle. It's not about power of who always wins. It has to be focused on a win-win approach. And it's a way to solve a problem that is vexing both the parties. And the only way to get to the heart of the problem is to try to see it through the lens of the other party. Now, today, in this information-based negotiations, in the digital age, what is dynamically changing? So technology has eased research. So for example, like I talk about the market research, the first thing that I will do as a buyer is get online. I will get onto a search engine. I will try and dig out facts very quickly. I will get on social media. I will try and dig insights into what is the solution that is available. If I can identify an organization that is offering, I'll read the history about that organization. If there is a famous person within that organization, say a great seller, somebody's talked about, the social media has talked about that person, I'll try and dig out more information about that person and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, what does all of this do? It it actually is a very radically different approach to negotiation. Now, it will emphasize deep knowledge of the supplier and their industry. Now, for the buyer, this is very important, because when a buyer sits on that negotiating table, he cannot go in blindfolded, cannot sit on that table and show to a seller that he's clueless about what the seller has to offer. And it is different from some of the traditional approaches to negotiations. So it is not the adversarial negotiation style with the emphasis on, we read a lot of theory about game playing, about theatrics and taking advantage of a supplier's weakness. It's not about that. It's more around information-based negotiations that both sides are equally informed of the other party. So a seller will probably get online and do a research about the buyer and their organization. And similarly, a buyer will get online and do a lot of research about the seller and their organization and the products and do a detailed deep dive into the solutions that are available. What are the margins? What is the culture about that organization? And the best way to describe it is that the purchasing or the supply chain professional knows almost as much or more about the supplier or the seller and their industry as the buyer himself does. And they actually then become a data-driven industry expert. Traditionally, a buyer always dependent on the seller to come and educate the buyer. Right. About their solution, about their product and services, versus today in the digital era, the buyer would have done a deep dive, would have done their research, would have understood and identified the organization, its capability, looked at peer reviews, spoken to a lot of their own peers and network in trying to assess and gauge the service offerings, the issues around their services and so on, and then sit on the table as a more informed buyer in this whole digital era.
So one of the thoughts that I have seen being shared is that one core objective has to be that the outcome is extraordinary for both the selling and the buying parties. Like you mentioned, win-win. It has to be outcome which both parties win. It's an era where you ensure that the supplier also gets the correct value and outcome out of the transaction as much as the buyer.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because if a buyer always wins, then he'll come to a point where probably nobody will actually come to him. Or the sellers will really buffer up their solution in terms of pricing and what they have to offer, because they know that this buyer makes it a point to always win and he demands always.
Yeah, that's true. So one of the things that I, when I'm talking to, the community and talking to experts like you, is that I think that the war analogies have outlived their use, in the buying selling context. We need to sort of move away from all the analogies of winning and losing, and we have to get into a more, for the lack of a better word, a win-win kind of model, which is not expressed in those terms,
So the way that I put it, it has to be more collaborative, yes, more partnership, yes, model, yes, more strategic partnership. Make your suppliers as partners in your business. And when they see themselves as partners in the business, I think they will invest more in your business as an organization, because they will also understand that if they fail or if their solution fails, it is actually a joint failure, not an individual failure. It will not be an organizational failure versus a seller failure. It will be their failure collectively and
absolutely
combined.
Absolutely.
And therefore, that mindset needs to start coming in. So gone are the days when the seller comes up and says, oh, I've done the deal. I can now wash my hands off. Thank you very much. I'm out of this game. It is no longer now. The entire dynamics has to change. And as we move forward, the partnership model has to evolve and strengthen, not just evolve, but it has to strengthen, and both sides have to understand that they're there for a longer duration, for a longer time frame. Right. And also, I talk about another one or two things is, if I were to use an analogy to explain, and I go back to where that need had originated. Now, procurement, the way that it is placed within an organization, is actually acting like a bridge, because it connects the internal business needs to the external world.
Right.
And unless the procurement deeply understands the available solutions, the key players, and the ability to bring suitable business solutions to the internal businesses, the procurement professional will not be able to showcase that value to that organization. That is not easy. It is not simple, because a user, after they've identified the need, built the business case, they've signed off, and now the responsibility transfers to procurement, the entire ownership is now of that procurement manager who's dealing with the selling organization. And unless the manager has a very deep understanding of the internal business requirements, the processes, the holistic view on the business solutions, he cannot do what is generally called the matchmaking process of getting the suitable solution to the internal user.
Right.
And it does not also end there, because the way that I look at it is also about balancing of the powers. Now, sometimes I've seen that the user is also very unrealistic in their demands and the requirements that they pose on procurement. In terms, so they may want the world, they may dream up of the world, but is the world actually available out there for them? They may want the moon and the stars, but is it actually available for the procurement person to actually deliver on it? So somewhere, the procurement responsibility also lies in balancing, in doing the balancing act to say, look, you wanted the stars and the moons, but actually it's not available, but this is what is available. And I think it suits the requirement of that organization, because I also understand the business need. I also understand the process. I have a very holistic view on the solutions that are available and what the business needs are. And therefore, it dovetails and meets our requirements.
It's time for a short break. I asked Aval, from his vantage point, how does he see the changes the buyer is going through and how the vendors are reacting to these changes? He will explain why agility is becoming key to the buying procurement process in a rapidly changing scenario. Stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. Right before the break, I asked Aval what changes the buyers are going through and how the vendors are reacting to these changes. Listen in. How have you seen the buyer actually changing his process, and how do you think the sales organizations are reacting to that change?
So it's, I think it's a very interesting question, and the way that I would put it is, I think there's no straight answer, but it's a mixed bag. Now, obviously, in today's time, the buyer, I'll go back again to the organization. The organization models are changing. The business models are changing today. And as we move forward from a very traditional mindset to how businesses would operate a few years ago to how they're operating today, and how they would operate in the future. Now, obviously, in this whole ecosystem, there are varying requirements that are coming up with this whole changing landscape. And therefore, it poses a different kind of a challenge on procurement to now start to get out to the market and to deliver to those changing requirements within the organization. One of the key aspects that is now a kind of a basic requirement is agility, because the requirements are changing so fast. And also the fact that going back again, the balancing act, which is now sitting in the negotiating rooms. So it's forget about the BATNAs that we generally talk about, which is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, or forget about the negotiation plans or the Excel spreadsheets, which are lying in front of the buyers most of the time. But it's also to focus a lot on the human behaviors, which sometimes may not go according to the plan. But if you bring in the EQ, the emotional quotient, into your entire negotiations, that could also create a flip to that environment. Now, and which comes to the point of creating that or striking that chord with the seller, or the, for the seller with the buyer, is how do I create that connection? How do I create that trust? How do I build that confidence with the buyer from a seller standpoint? After I've taken the buyer through my knowledge sharing, through my education session, trying to meet somewhere between what is expected from the buying organization and from the buyer versus what do I have to offer, and I may not be able to meet that 100% requirement, but can I do something to at least get to the 90% or the 80% stage where the critical requirements are met? Some are must have, but some are good to have requirements. But I am committed in this partnership. I am committed to convert that good to have also to must have, but give me time. Let me go back to my organization. Let me put that in a upskilling or a development process, and I will come back with a solution. But today I have this to offer. It meets the critical requirement. I can create value. I can bring benefit to the organization. Go ahead with this, and I will make sure that the balance of the 10%, 15, 20% is also met over a period of time in our partnership.
So how many from your experience, how many sales organizations are actually tuned to this thought?
So in the past, very few actually. And again, going back to the premise that a salesperson has come with a sales mindset. I have to make a sale and that's it. I'm not interested in the partnership model. I don't know how my organization is going to take this, whether they will be open to this partnership model, to this collaborative approach, to really investing in R&D, or to really making way to changing the whole solution or modifying the solution to meeting a requirement's needs. But as we move forward, as I look at it today, there are a few organizations. And I'll tell you a very classic example. Like, for example, today in the COVID environment, we are talking about getting back to business. The first foremost challenge is when my office is in a multi-tenanted building.
Right.
And I have lifts to utilize to get to my floor. How do I operate a lift? Now, traditionally, the lift manufacturer or the equipment manufacturer would say, you push buttons, the lift opens, you get into a lift, push buttons to your floor, and that's about it. But today, they're actually coming to say, I understand what the challenges are today. I am happy to retrofit my lift design to make it voice-activated elevators. I'm also enabling an app that your employees can download on the phone, which will do the same function of pressing a button to reach to your floor.
Right.
You don't have to click or you don't have to push the buttons in the lift. You can do the same thing on your phone. And you want to get to a fifth floor, you open the app, the buttons pop up, you press 5 and the lift door closes and takes you to your fifth floor. But these things have come today because they also understand the whole approach and the environment today. And somewhere it has pushed them to make these changes. Somewhere it is also coming as a demand from the users to say, this is a problem. How do we address it? And what do we change?
Right.
And this is just one example. And there are so many examples. When you look at the whole building operations, you will have similar aspects in building management systems. You would have similar aspects to how you manage your air conditioning environments. So your HVAC systems, your power backup systems, and so on. Your visitor management systems. Everything is starting to become touchless, starting to become more COVID friendly, as I call it today. And I think the environment is driving it. Something, the behavior is changing because the clients or the users are demanding it. And somewhere the suppliers themselves are coming forward to say that, look, I want to be seen as more participative. I want to be seen as more collaborative. And therefore, let me preempt and bring solutions to this environment and reach out to my consumers and tell them I have a fantastic solution to meet these challenges.
So that was great. I mean, would you have any other thoughts to share?
On this aspect, not really. But okay. I mean, going back to our original conversation, and we digressed, and then the whole dynamics of negotiation and how it's changing, and with technology and all of that piece. But I think at the end of at the end of all the negotiations, it actually boils down to then doing a comparative. And the comparative could have its own various parameters. The criteria will obviously be laid out by the procurement function. And because they would still want to create an apple to an apple kind of a comparative. And they would want to assess the various solutions that are available through various partners. And after having understood, deep dive, knowledge sharing, the education sessions, discussions, getting the emotions out of the whole piece, getting into the techno commercials, the value, then the terms and conditions of the buying organization would start to come into the picture is how would I actually buy and what would my terms be of buying? And that itself would involve a separate agency, which is the legal departments, from both sides, from both the entities and the organization, because it could not be just about the solution terms and conditions, but it could be also around a lot of other terms and conditions, sure, in terms of payment terms, in terms of force majeure clauses. And now, especially with COVID experience, I think a lot of organizations, and my view is probably a majority of the organizations, are going to start focusing on the force majeure clauses and kind of building a whole risk around force majeure cases. So today, when you saw a force majeure clause in a contract, you would probably just skip by and say, oh, this is something that probably will never get activated and so on or provoked. And today, people are actually realizing that, oh, what a mistake or what a blunder they did by actually not focusing. So a lot of focus on how do you build risk around that, risk mitigation strategies start going to be coming up in the future as we move along. So the terms and conditions are going to play a very, very critical role, even from a supplier risk mitigation. So again, I go back to an example that I again talk about a lot of times is most of the times when we set up agreements and contracts, we set them up with our tier one suppliers. Tier 1 suppliers are our immediate suppliers who are providing us that solution or providing us that product or a service. We never really talk about what are their dependencies, which could be from a Tier 2 supplier, as we classify them, or a Tier 3 supplier. And you may have an absolute watertight contract or an agreement with your Tier 1 supplier. But what if the tier one or their tier two supplier fails in their commitment, and a tier one is unable to deliver to their commitment? At the end of it, your organization still gets impacted. And in most of the cases, going by history and tradition, most of the organizations and their procurement functions never really focus beyond tier one. And this is something that I've been promoting and I've been talking about the last couple of years in a lot of my address and a lot of my discussions and talk on procurement is, guys, I think it is very, very important. It is very, very critical that we start focusing and talking about our tier two and our tier three suppliers, because a large amount of our risk actually sits in that bucket of our tier two and our tier three supplier. And let us also start bringing that up during our negotiations and during our discussions around setting up terms and conditions and setting up terms for our agreement and our contract, is how do you de-risk yourself from the risk associated with your tier two and the tier three suppliers?
Right, right.
So that itself will now start probably, if better sense prevails, we'll start to figure out in a lot of our conversations going forward, with our lessons learned with COVID, for most of the organizations. And there'll be a lot of focused discussions around trying to gain visibility and some kind of an assurance and visibility by the buying organizations of the vendors tier two and the tier three. So what are their dependencies? And they'll start to, some kind of a matrix will start to build up in their contracts. And they will start insisting about getting visibility around these. But probably once those terms are ironed out between the legal departments, between the users and so on, probably it's a stage where then the procurement or the buying buyers will be confident enough to go back now to the requester and start getting or looking towards internal approvals. And these internal approvals, depending on what their authorized signatory matrix is within the organization, could go back to the business, could again go back to CFO, I think definitely, because he holds the strings to the purse in an organization. And from an organization standpoint, I think the CEO and the COO, depending on where the responsibility sits of their buy-in. And once that is approved is when the buyer comes back to the seller and says, now we have a deal. We are ready to sign. These are the terms that we've agreed and so on. And then that deal eventually gets signed, and but the process of buying does not still end at that stage. And I talk again a lot about managing relationships with suppliers. So my focus is always building an ongoing relationship with suppliers. Obviously, again, if an organization works with thousands of suppliers, it's not really humanly possible to really engage and maintain relationships with all those thousands. But again, I go back to that Pareto's principle of the 80-20 rule.
Right.
So where does your 80% of your spend lie? Probably with those 20% of your critical suppliers, and identify the top suppliers out of that lot and start interacting more closely, start meeting them more regularly, more formally, informally. Start building relationships and start managing those relationships through monthly reviews, through quarterly business reviews. And then as you start to work collaboratively together and as the partnership models mature within the organization, I think you also then start focusing at building the next level to innovation and higher levels of collaboration, joint R&Ds, jointly looking at upgrading these solutions when you are locked in over a longer period. And again, I go back to what is that life cycle of either that equipment or that solution. So for example, you may have bought a centralized air conditioning plant and the life cycle is for 9 years. So you are locked in into that marriage, the so-called marriage with that supplier over a 9 year, at least minimum, unless the supplier is able to provide you upgrades in their equipment, change a few parts, update their software and so on, and extend that life by say another 2, 3, 4 years or 5 years. Similarly with a lot of other equipment that you have in place and so on. So the procurement the cycle does not stop at buying, but goes on till the life of that product or that solution. And that is where the buyer plays a very, very important role. While the user is very happy because he's got what he wants and is using the product or that service, but it's very critical and a lot of responsibility rests on the buyer of how they approach the selling organization and how they engage with them, how they develop relations with them, what is the kind of support that is provided to them, what is it that they develop with the selling organization over a period of time.
Great. Before I let you go, I have one final question. Till pretty much late into the process, the vendor doesn't get a peek into the need. And even then, there are so many steps involved in the vendor actually trying to figure out what outcome the customer is actually looking for and so on. How can you get into this process early into the game? How can you get involved earlier into the decision-making process so that you can help the customer with that change, requirement, definition and mindset?
So I think this conversation is best had during the knowledge sharing and the education session. Now, I've had through my corporate journey,
right,
number of occasions where actually the suppliers have advised me on a better solution or a better offering or an upgrade to what I'm asking them, because there's already the next step that is available in the market and it doesn't cost you much.
Right.
For an incremental price difference, you can get something which is much, much superior, much better, much agile solution that is available. Now, the entire discussion prior to that knowledge sharing discussion is something which is probably more internal focused.
Right.
It is about the generation of the need and then the whole process of tying in the various stakeholders within the organization, getting the buy-in, building the business case and the model. Yes, probably at that point in time when the user is building the business case, maybe if he approaches the procurement at that stage and procurement reaches out into the market to say or to kind of determine if a solution of a similar nature is available and starts interacting with potential suppliers to really build up the business case also. But those kind of cases are very far and very few, because it all actually boils down to the business requirement. What does the business need? And in my view, I think it's more when you're sitting with those suppliers during the knowledge sharing and education sessions would be an opportune time for the selling organization to actually start educating of whether there is something better that is available in terms of a solution or a product or alternate products, alternate solutions which could actually push the organization to a new level altogether from what they are demanding or experiencing.
Great. Thank you, Aval, for your time. I really enjoyed it. It was very, very detailed, and I appreciate that, because most of the time we don't go into this kind of detail, and it doesn't give the clarity to the seller how the buyer's mind is working and what is happening behind the scenes, which they will never get exposed to. I think this has been a great session. Would you have anything else to add?
It's been fantastic talking to you, and again, thank you so much for this opportunity to be able to speak my mind out and talk about procurement, which I'm very, very passionate about. Spend a number of years, and whatever I do it with a lot of passion. So one thought that I always again have is that at the end of it all, procurement, if you actually look at it, is a sales job. Because in every deal that I've been through, I would have to sell to my suppliers on why I deserve that competitive price among all of their other customers, who could be bigger organizations, who could have bigger budgets, they could have bigger and probably better teams to support the whole project or the implementation. Resource is limited and competition is obviously very fierce. But if I cannot demonstrate my ability to add value to the supplier's current position, I will not or never get the best deal. Because the supplier also, from his standpoint, would say, I'm here only to sell. This organization cannot add anything, or it's not a big brand. I cannot boast about partnering with them and use that leverage to sell to other clients. So I have a very tough call to really push my way through so that I'm able to get a good deal. And the process itself will always involve identifying the uniqueness of my own company, which I'm representing, and presenting the value that could be put on the table to that potential supplier. And if I look at my entire peers and the entire buyers per se, as I interact with them, some of the good buyers that I've seen, or the procurement professionals that I've seen, I can probably blindly say that they're almost 100% of the times excellent salespeople too. So just a thought, my perspective.
That's a very, very interesting thought. It's like every buyer is also seller in his own business, right? So every business is selling something while it's buying something else. But the buying process itself is a selling process, and vice versa is a very interesting take, Aval.
The Buyer Side Chat is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink enables high-quality interactions between buyers and sellers through presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create personalized sales presentations and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversation. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 650-847-5884. That is 650-847-5884.
Thank you so much. And I would really look forward to chatting with you more on specific bits and do more detailed chats with you in the future.
Sure. Thank you so much. And I'll look forward to those chats.
Thank you.
Coming up in the next episode is an insightful conversation with Arun Varadarajan, EVP and Global Head of Digital Business at NIIT Technologies.
80 to 90% of sales managers are absolutely reviewing the wrong thing. They are reviewing numbers. I agree, the numbers are important. They are the outcomes. But they are the lag indicators. They're not the lead indicators. To me, the lead indicators are, is your salesperson really knowledgeable about the accounts he is going after or she is going after? Does she really understand the customers that she is serving? Does she understand the industry she serves? These are, to me, in leading indicators that will give you a sense that your sales team is executing and operating well. You know, what happens is sometimes a salesperson just gets lucky. She shows up and voila, she closes a deal. It's in spite of her, not because of her. And this tendency to focus on the lag indicator, which is the number, is absolutely the wrong thing to do.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of weeks. Stay tuned.
Thank you for being with us today on the Buyer Side Chat. This is the podcast of record for the buyer side journey. And those who know, that's the journey that matters. We hope this conversation helped you with insights that you can go and apply right now to your own value transaction process. See you in the next episode of the Buyer Side Chat.